Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and I am joined here by two of my lovely co-hosts.
Hello, hello. This is Essie Fleenor. Super pumped to be here today. And I'm here with another of our hosts.
You know, it's so good to meet you two. I've heard so much about you, and I'm so glad to be here.
I literally live downstairs from you.
That's you then. Okay. Now I see. You're I'm that so Monica? Oh my God.
Oh, I'm so jealous whenever y'all are like, we're doing this neighbor thing. I'm like, screw you. I'm moving in.
Well, be that as it may. We have a wonderful guest here today who I am very excited to introduce. This is Alina Pete.
Hey, everybody. Namoya Alina Pete. I am from Little Pine First Nation in Saskatchewan, Canada. Yeah. And I am a role-playing gamer, writer, cartoonist, LARPer, all-around nerd.
Sweet.
And you live where it's even colder than it is in Minnesota, where Monica and I are.
Mm-hmm. I got so many stories about minus 40 winters, let me tell you.
Lord have mercy.
Yeah, we were crying at much, much less
than like negative two. And I was just like, yep, I'm over it.
Mm-hmm. No, I fled Saskatchewan. I'm out in on the West Coast now. I'm out in BC. So it's a little warmer here.
Oh, I see.
Negative 40 is a little warmer.
Yeah, a little bit. Here, no, it's not bad. It like barely gets down to freezing. I forget what that is in Fahrenheit.
Oh, geez.
Just balmy.
Yeah. Pretty good.
I was like, which one's Fahrenheit? Wait, I don't even know which one's freezing in there. You know what? I wish I hadn't said anything.
30? I don't remember. Minus 40 is the cheat because it's minus 40 in both. So that's always my go-to.
Welcome to Bitches on Comics, where we don't understand degrees.
We are Americans. How to say you're American without saying you're American? What is the metric system?
Honestly, I was having a discussion with my editor earlier where I was like, it's actually really bad being Canadian because like I have to go through all my manuscripts and make sure that I've used the right spellings and units for everything. Because I just do it randomly. I'm like, I don't remember what the Canadian spelling is. This sounds right.
It's fine. The United States is ass backwards. Like, we do everything that nobody else in the world does. Why? I don't know.
We're the ones. And then we act like it's everybody else.
I know. And then we're just like, how dare everybody be different? USA something. I hate it here.
Oh, you've all decided upon something? Well, we've decided to do whatever the opposite of it is. And that's what we're rolling with.
Because freedom.
Freedom.
Oh, man. We are starting nice and light today.
God, we were just discussing the weather.
I love that all three of us are like, you know what? Hard pass. This whole country, hard pass. Yeah, you know. Well, Alina, tell us a little bit more about your comics career, because I have been... doing my research and been very excited to see so many years of Were Geeks, which we will have to talk about, obviously. But then also you've got a lot of different projects going on. And of course, we'll dig into Women in the Woods, the reason we're here today. But I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about, you know, how you got into comics. What is it that you like about comics? What do you see your role as a comic creator? As philosophical or practical as you feel like being today.
Sure,
it's still tourist season, so you can take it practical.
Okay, let's do this. I originally didn't want to be in comics. I loved comics growing up, but I didn't read a lot of mainstream comics because various people in my family disagreed with the idea of like, why are there so many boobs on the covers of these comics that you're reading? Why can't you read something nicer? So I was allowed to read like Archie comics and Sonic the Hedgehog and stuff like that. But I found that Mango was a nice cheat because many of the characters on the cover just look like sweet little kids. And that's great for a 14-year-old to read. So I got really into Mango for a while.
And then the horny interiors. Yeah. Like, yes!
Yeah, I was like, don't open that, Grandma. Nope. do not open that book, please.
Just look at the cover. Just look
it's
at
fine.
The cover.
It's great. It's good. So I originally wanted to be an animator, and I went to animation school straight out of high school because I had big dreams of working for Disney. And then I took a year off to go traveling. And when I got back, my animation school had fallen apart. So I went, well, I'd like to still practice my skills. There's no other animation school on the prairies. So maybe I'll try drawing this webcomic thing that I've heard about, that I read a few of online. That's a good way to practice and make sure I like update several times a week, every week, forever. And then 15 years passed and I had been doing WereGeek for really a long time. So yeah, and then while I was doing that, I was like, I like WereGeek. It's a comic that's about role-playing games and the people who play them. There's a little bit of slice of life. But I was like, this is fun, but I have so many other stories I want to tell, and a lot of those have to do with being Indigenous. And that was something that I didn't really explore in WereGeek. So I started doing shorter stories and like 10 to 12 page short story comics that I started submitting to anthologies. So I think my first one was a little local printer comics collective in town here called Cloudscape Comics. And I did a story about two Indigenous cowboys riding dinosaurs in the Badlands around Drumheller. And it was sort of a YA book for an anthology called Megafauna, because I am obsessed with dinosaurs as well. So that kind of got me started on my whole anthology track. And since then, I've been in several anthologies. The latest one that's coming out is A Howl, which I just got the printing update on that one. I'm really excited to see that. And then a couple years ago, my friend Kel, who was one of the co-editors on The Woman in the Woods, approached me and was like, so we've been doing this book series called Cautionary Fables that are fables set from around the world. So there's the first one was the European stories. They've done Africa, Asia, Oceania. And now they wanted to do North America, but they were like, we would like someone who is Indigenous to be involved with this because we're going to be telling Indigenous stories. And I went, that is a great idea. How about I come on and I'll help you navigate that, because Indigenous stories can be kind of a tricky waters to run around in. All of the stories don't belong to any individual person, but they belong to the nations that tell them. So I knew that there was a whole bunch of protocol to get through if we were going to try and publish these stories in a printed format.
That was one of the things that I was curious about with that, because I was like, I'm guessing that there were stories that you had not heard before and that were new to you. So I was wondering what your experience with that was, because you have, there's a lot of different creators that work on this.
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, and because we wanted it to be all North America, we wanted to make sure that all of the nations from around North America were represented as well as we could have them. We knew that there was only, you know, limited space in the books. These are supposed to be somewhat shorter anthologies, so that they are not overwhelming for the YA sort of audience. But I also knew that every nation has their own protocols surrounding these stories. And I'm Cree, from Saskatchewan. So I know our ways of navigating that. But I also knew that like the writers for this would have to approach the elders and people in their community about this, using whatever protocols were fine for them, and then ask permission in their own way. So right up front, when Kel and Kate Ashwin is the other co-editor on this book, we sat down and I was like, okay, well, here's how this is going to have to work. We're going to have to be real upfront with all of the writers and be like, okay, we want you to go and do whatever protocols are appropriate for your people and ask permission to tell the story and then come and pitch that story to us so that we were doing everything in the right way.
That's fascinating, because it's like there's sort of layers of approval, and, you know, I'm not even sure approval is fully the right word. So tell me if there's a better word there.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it was such an interesting curatorial process. So did you sort of talk to people, I guess, like how many people pitched beyond what was selected, or was it close to the same group, or yeah. Well, tell me more of the process. Just dig in deeper. I want to know everything.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Maybe I'll jump back half a step and just say that part of the reason that these stories are so, I mean, not really protected is maybe not the right term for it, but the reason that there's so many protocols around them is that they are seen as living things. So when I was a kid, my mom actually was a storyteller that would go around to different schools within our school district and tell the stories. But in order to be a storyteller, you have to have this like mentorship where you learn how to tell them correctly. And we were already doing it sort of one step removed because neither of us speak Cree. My grandfather spoke Cree, but he never taught his children how to speak it. So we were already learning the stories in English. And my mom went out and she earned herself the right to tell several stories. And doing that is sort of like, because they're a living thing, you tell them and you have to tell them the way that they were told to you. You can't change them. So before I was allowed to tell the stories, I had to go out and mentorship, intern under her for a while. And I would go around to the schools and just listen every time she told them, note her mannerisms, note the inflection that she spoke in. And then a couple times she got me to tell one of the stories to her in private. And then once she put me on a spot in front of a group of kids, and was like, all right, now it's your turn. Tell this story. So I earned the right to tell a couple of the stories, which is part of how I knew about all this protocol. So they're, because they're living beings that are now being translated already to English, but then now translated from English to the page and to a graphic format, that was a whole big thing. So we got quite a few people pitching different ideas to us. And we thought that there would be people pitching the same stories, and we didn't get any duplications. So we had quite a good group to choose from. And part of the problem was that we were doing this during COVID. So we had a few other groups that we've been hoping to get stories from, one of which I still regret that we don't have any representation from the North, from like the Innu people or anyone who's sort of living up in the Arctic or Northern communities. And that was partially just because, like, as COVID was happening, we could not get in contact with everybody. The lines of communication were really falling apart. So I still regret that we weren't able to get one of those stories because they have some amazing legends. The legend of Sedna, the goddess of the sea, is like one of my favorites.
That's so interesting how the stories are living things, but like they still don't change over time. So like it's passed on through generations, but there's no like additions that happen to them, like, or even any attempt to like try to modernize the stories in order to get people to relate to them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and there is certain ways that you can modernize stories because obviously Moonshot 2 was reimaginings of old like traditional legends. So again, we were in that one sort of said, we want to tell traditional stories, but then put them in a modern setting or tell them in a modern way. And it's up to you to go ahead and do that. So they'd kind of modeled for me what an anthology would look like, where they were taking those protocols into mind just before they asked us to then go out and reinvent these things.
Did you face any resistance when you expressed your want to publish these stories?
A little bit. I know I was really scared about when I wanted to tell a story in Moonshot called Katepwa. Katepwa is Cree for who calls. And my grandmother's side of the family is from a valley in Saskatchewan called Capelle, which is the French word for Katepwa. It basically still means who calls. And there's a legend in that valley about how there are beings that live in the lake, and they'll call out to you and try to trick you and bring you out onto the lake in the water and confuse you. And there was a particular legend that I was retelling about a man who was coming to marry a woman who lived in that area, and he got led astray by these creatures. And when he finally got there, his beloved had passed away. So it's sort of a tragic story. And I took that and I set it in the modern times and then had it be a commentary on the missing and murdered Indigenous women. So I was really a little bit scared to go to my elders to talk about that one, because I was like, okay, here's the reason why I want to tell this story. I think it's really important, and I think it reflects a lot of the things that are going on within modern Indigenous communities, but I also know that this is a traditional story about some of the spiritual creatures of our valley, and that there's a whole bunch of protocols about talking about them and not naming them directly. So how do I do this? Is this even a thing I can do? And the elders I spoke to were actually really, really pleased and like, this is a great idea. We like that you're doing this, and here's how to navigate that. And sort of gave me their blessings to tell that story.
That's so cool. It actually reminds me of certain African like stories and African folklore where the traditions are definitely passed down from generation to generation, but there are strict laws like as to not write them down, because like the stories are actually about living deities and it can be seen as like a sign of disrespect. And by like speaking the stories like orally, we are actually paying homage to our ancestors and deities by letting the story manifest within whatever circle it's being told in. And like, if you have it published, like there's like a certain like energy that goes into like those words or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I'd heard that there was a lot of similarities between African storytelling and North American storytelling. But I really love that there's ideas that a lot of their tricksters are still around and still doing things. And so it's totally fine to have the trickster stories like take place in the modern world, because it's reflective of the fact that like they're still here and they're still with us.
Yeah, I automatically thought of like Elegua, who's like the trickster and like the master of like the crossroads with them voodoon while reading Chokfi. And like, I just like thought it was like really interesting about how the trickster is just like the ultimate storyteller, and just like getting people to think about like the multiple paths that they go down and like looking at their lives as a whole and like how everything is interconnected.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of wish Kel was here right now, because I want to ask them if they had similar protocols in on the Cautionary Fables Africa edition, which I wasn't involved with.
Oh, wow. I haven't heard of that.
Oh, that book is so cool. There's one story in there called The Woman Who Married a Skull that I absolutely love. And I love the art style on the story as well.
I will definitely check it out.
Yeah, I was like, what? We need to get that. I didn't even know that that had been released. That's amazing. I knew that this was part of a series, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's put out with Iron Circus Comics, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, their whole publishing model is the most wild thing in the world. So mm-hmm. I think it's really awesome. We're about ready to interview Spike coming up.
Oh,
so.
Man. Spike's interview is going to be great. Spike is a badass, and I love chatting with her.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had worked, if there had been a lot of crossover on the project. Did you end up talking with her a lot?
Not a lot. She, the Cautionary Fables stories are kind of a new acquisition for Iron Circus. Before, it was just being produced under Kel's sort of publishing brand, Kel McDonald. I think it's just kelmcdonald.com. But Kel and Kate Ashwin have been the editors on the series since the beginning. And I believe we're the fifth book in the series. They are working on another one. But there's Europe, Africa, Asia, Oceania, and now North America. It's a whole five book series, which is part of why the Kickstarter did so well for this one. When we were crowdfunding it, you could buy just this book or you could get the entire series. And I know a lot of people have discovered it and sort of gone like, oh, this is a great teaching resource. If you're like doing a unit on like world legends in your classes, like pick up all the books and then the kids can read all of the different legends from around the world and kind of see how they're similar and how they're different. So yeah, I know there was quite a few multi-book sets.
Yeah, I imagine if you were, you know, going to kickstart it and you saw that package, it'd be hard to turn down. I always find myself being like, oh, I can get three more books for more money. Done. I'm in. So
yeah,
I relate to that.
I'm also really bad for forgetting what I've ordered and then it shows up and I'm like, oh yeah.
I love that feeling. I'm like, oh, look, my library just grew so much. I was feeling good that day I supported that Kickstarter. My bank account must have looked great. I'm curious. I would love to hear a little bit more about, you know, we talked about the early selection process, but as you started to piece the anthology together, were there common themes or were there, you know, I know we talked a little bit about wanting sort of a broad representation through North America, but I'm curious, you know, was there something else that was a guiding light there for you?
It was actually super interesting because we got a bunch of different genres submitted to us. So like one of the stories, I believe it's called Into the Darkness, is actually a horror story about a supernatural being from sort of the Southwest. And then we have sort of a funnier story about Chokfi, who's the rabbit trickster figure. We also have White Horse Plains, which is a really interesting one because that's sort of a historical moment. It tells the story of when two chiefs of different tribes were presiding over a wedding between their children. And so there was this like almost Game of Thronesy element to it where it was like, oh, is this alliance going to work out or not? What's going to happen? Tragedy strikes. I was really pleased to like look at the stories that we got and see such a diversity of genres between them. Because I think a lot of people, their only contact with these sort of legends before are some of the creation myths. If they've heard any of them at all. And I know a lot of people haven't heard basically any indigenous myths. But if they've heard any of them, they might have heard stuff like you know, How the Rabbit Lost Its Tail, or some of the coyote stories where coyotes run around tricking people. We actually didn't get many trickster stories at all, except for the Chokefee story. So I was glad to represent that one in here. But I thought we'd have to be fighting between, you know, this coyote story or that coyote story. Coyote's one of my favorites.
Oh, love coyote. It sounds like you thought there was going to be a lot more of comparing like to like, and it was a lot more eclectic than that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we have our Decoded Pride anthology that we do every June, and it's, you know, we have them really loose in terms of theme. It's generally just, if you're queer or trans and you want to write a weird / speculative story, send it to us. And if we like it, we'll print it. And sometimes we discover themes, but I think I also thought we'd have more like, oh, which murder mermaid story should we publish? And it just really hasn't worked out quite that way. So it's interesting how sometimes it just pieces itself together almost, where it's like the stories, they want to fit together. I also was really deeply moved by how, like, the representation of two-spirit people, by the diverse sort of attractions shown, the queer story of the woman in the woods. I really loved that. And I was just curious, you know, we know one of the big things sometimes can be, oh, queer content isn't accessible for kids, which is like, I can't even. But I'm curious, you know, for you, was that any of the consideration? Were you particularly excited to see those stories? Did they just naturally fit? I'm just curious about the queer content in particular, if you have anything in particular about that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we didn't ask for it, but we got it in spades. I was so excited. We weren't even really conscious of it at first. We were just like, I love this story. I love this story. We each put together our short list of like, here's my like top 15 favorites, let's compare. And we had a bunch of them that were all on the same page for that. And then we looked at them afterwards and we're like, there are a lot of queer creators who have submitted to here, and several stories that are very, very diverse. Like As It Was Told to Me is just this really, really cool story about sort of accepting yourself and being different. And the art style is absolutely amazing. So we were looking at our list of creators and we were going, I think we are almost 50% people who are queer or gender nonconforming, which is really cool. We didn't go looking for that. It just happened. And I think part of that is because Iron Circus has a really good reputation for being very open and accepting and promoting of anybody who's not represented on the pages nearly enough.
Yeah, Iron Circus rules. We'll just say it again.
Yep.
Another time on the, put it on the record again. Absolutely.
Go to their website and buy all of their comics. To everyone.
Yeah.
To everyone. No, not to Alina specifically.
No.
I was Alina, saying, you also, go buy
to their to their now Eisner-nominated comics. I'm so proud of my co-editor, Cal, who just got nominated for an Eisner for the other anthology they did with Iron Circus called You Die.
Oh, it's so cool. Well, you know, I wanted to just go back to As It Was Told to Me again, that first story in the anthology. Just, I was so moved by it. I was so delighted. I mean, every single story was just like, this is so fun. This is so beautiful. This is so scary. This is all those things at once. And I just thought it was so powerful to start with a story about the creator thinking about whether or not to create life and choosing to do it, knowing how much bad would happen because there was going to be really good things too. And I was like, damn, if that is not like the message I needed to hear at this point in my life, I don't know what was. So yeah, maybe it's a YA book. Maybe it's also the book we all desperately need in our hearts and souls, because it's such a, and I really, you know, and I know this is true in many Indigenous communities. I really appreciated the way the narrative pushed against thinking of male and feminine, or masculine and feminine, as, you know, two sides of the same coin, but rather as two integrated pieces. And what does it mean to have those things integrated? So then, you know, good and bad, those, they aren't a dichotomy, they're integrated. And that was just, it was such a short story. And it was, I bawling my eyes out, just bawling. It was so beautiful and so sweet. And I really just, I thought it was such a perfect place to start too. Obviously being like the creation story a little bit makes sense, but also to start with two spirit voices right there front and center. Is that part of why you chose it?
A little bit. Like the story literally starts at like a two spirit support group. So like, we were just like, yeah, let's set the tone on this. Let's just be like, hey y'all, we're all welcome to read this book. Come on in. And part of the other reason that I was really glad to start off with that book is I know it's not necessarily this way in every nation, but in a lot of the nations, and especially in the Cree Nation, there are no gendered pronouns, which I love, being non-binary myself. The only distinction is animate or inanimate. So all people, and by people I don't just mean humans, I mean like animals and plants, insects, even water and stones are all animate beings. They're all beings with a spirit and a life of their own. And inanimate things are things that are dead. So an animal is an animate thing, but once its bones have been exposed and are out in the sun, that is an inanimate object now. But the stone beside it is animate. And the idea that there is no distinction between male or female or non-binary or anyone else, that we're all just people, and that that same distinction goes between humans and everything else that we rely on in this big internet connected web is like right at the heart of Indigenous thinking and something that I get really excited talking about and think more people need to learn about.
There's already been like three times in this interview where I'm like, oh, I have to rethink everything. and that's one where I'm like, oh man, yeah, 100%. Like, but now I have to re-examine my entire life a little bit. So
I'm bringing the decolonial theory and blowing your minds.
I know, definitely. I'm like, all right, BRB, BRB. I got to like think about this and then come back.
Yeah. I forgot to warn you all, my mom is a decolonizing educator, and I have grown up talking about this stuff literally since I was like two.
Amazing. Amazing.
No warning needed. A beautiful gift.
I'm curious to know what your process was for selecting writers for the book.
Ooh, yeah. So we had a submission process where we got a form on the website. We're like, hey, submit your pitches to this. Pitch us your story idea. Tell us what nation they're from. And sort of how you're going to tell it. And then we sat down and picked our favorites of that. Like I said, we had our little short lists of like, well, here's my favorites, here's Kate's favorites, here's Cal's favorites. Most of our favorites were all the same. And then we took a look at our page count, picked our top 10, contacted them, saw what we could get. But we also paid attention in that list to making sure that we weren't just like overrepresenting the Great Plains or, you know, the Southern United States. I'd actually sort of broken it up into regions. So it was like Pacific Northwest coastal, Southwest California, New Mexico kind of area, Great Plains, Ontario, sort of Great Lakes, Black Swamp region, Southeast US coast and Eastern provinces, and then the North. And like I said, we couldn't get stories from there to represent everyone in those groups. Or even each of those groups, like in the case of the North. But I think we did a pretty good job of kind of making sure we blanketed as much of North America as we could.
Very nice. So did you have a difficult decision, like figuring out which pieces you wanted to be in the book? Like, were you bummed about like some of the pieces that you had to ultimately turn down? And also, adding to this question, if you did have to turn down any pieces where it was like a tough decision, are you thinking about making another book?
Ooh, we actually didn't have to turn anybody down. We had a pretty, I don't remember the selection process being particularly difficult at all. We had one like quick Zoom meeting and we were like, yeah, I think we're all on the same page for this one.
Nice.
Cool. Let's lock that in.
Absolutely. That's so great.
Yeah. But we definitely were like, there's potentially room to do more with these. It feels like we didn't quite get enough. And like I mentioned, we had some trouble with COVID happening during our production process.
Right.
Had some stories that were potentially lined up that we then just couldn't move ahead on. And then there was a story in there that I have illustrated, and I wasn't intending to do that originally. I've kind of set myself a rule. So when I'm working on an anthology, I won't do a story in it. I won't try and contribute because I want to make sure there's room for everybody else in there. I want to really, especially with Indigenous creators, I really want to set the spotlight for them, not me. But I also know that life happens and sometimes people have to drop out. So I was kind of setting myself in reserve as the only Indigenous creator on our co-editor team to jump in and pick up the slack if we lost somebody. Because obviously if you get most of the way through a creation process and then you're like, there's two pages left that you just need to finish up. Can we finish them, please? And then they'll be in the book. I could jump in on that and finish them up. We ran into a situation where we'd lined up the amazing, amazing artist, Jeffrey Vereggi, who's done a lot of covers for Marvel. He's got this amazing Pacific Northwest style. Some of you have probably seen his Batman piece. It's amazing. But he got sick during this process. He was diagnosed with lupus, and he was actually in a coma for quite some time, and I believe is still recovering from that right now. So we didn't have a cover, and he had submitted a story that he'd written, but he hadn't even started the sketches on it before he fell ill. So we lost touch with him for a while. Obviously, like, his family had much bigger things to do than respond to our emails. But we really, really, really liked that story, and we wanted it in the book, and we didn't have anything else for the Pacific Northwest represented in there. So with only like a couple weeks left to go to print, I was like, how about I jump in there and draw it? And I'd been looking for another Pacific Northwest style artist to try and take over that story instead, because I thought it was really important to have the Pacific Northwest style represented in that particular story, which is about Octopus Woman, who was like a big figure up here on the West Coast. And I'd been living up here long enough to be like, yeah, I'm not from here. I'm really not from here. The culture is very different. I would like somebody from here to step in and take that one. But the timeline was so short, and I had to like pull some all-nighters just to get it done as it was. So we just ran out of time on that one. And I had to make the call on that of going, okay, I am not a Pacific Northwest artist, and I feel uncomfortable drawing in that style, but I also know that this story needs it. I'm going to draw in my style, but there's a couple figures and panels that I have in mind that I want to have the West Coast style in as much as I can. Drew it, ran it by a couple friends just to make sure I wasn't doing anything wrong or messing it up or doing anything that was going to get me in trouble. And that I was honoring the story and the work and the culture as much as I could be, and then got it off to print. So I'm really glad that that story is in there.
Yeah, the glamorous life of an editor, right?
Yeah.
Wow, I'm so glad you told us that, because I was going to ask about that story specifically, obviously, because of your artwork on it. That story is wild. I could have never, ever guessed that was what unfolded. It seems so beautifully, I can't imagine it in a different art. I'm sure you can, because you spent some time doing it. but it's really a beautiful story, and I was very touched by it. I really liked it. You know, you said you wanted to honor that style. It also sounds like maybe you weren't able to be in conversation with the writer.
No.
So how did you know what to do? Like, what interpretation did you feel like you had license to take? Were there just really good descriptions? Like, how did you manage that as an artist? I would love to know.
We were flying by the seat of our pants on that one, because literally we had the only confirmation that we got from him was through his wife. I don't even think he was really conscious at that point, but his wife said, yes, I found the files and I know that he really wanted that story to be in there. So please go ahead with it. Cause we'd been asking, we'd heard the news that he had fallen ill, and we were like, oh no, we really want to move ahead with the story, especially because like, we know that he poured his heart into it and we want him to be featured in this book, but he definitely can't be involved at this point. So what do we do? We just got the sort of go ahead from his partner. And then we were like, cool, we're not going to bug him with this because he can't talk to us right now. He's got more important things to do. And like I said, there was like T-minus 2 weeks, maybe even less than that, to get this thing to the printer. We were like, okay, I'm just going to draw this as fast as I can and run it by some friends who know the culture out here better than I do and hope it's good enough.
Well, you could never tell that it was one of those situations.
I'm really glad.
Sometimes when you're under the wire, that's whenever I'll look back on something that I like had to complete so fast all of a sudden. And then I'm like, that was pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
I get kind of proud of myself, because it's almost the circumstances makes you be like, I appreciate what I did there. I was wondering if you'd like to talk about the cover, because I thought the cover is ridiculously beautiful and I would just like to hear about it.
Oh, thank you. The cover originally was supposed to be Jeffrey as well. So about the same time, we actually started on the cover before I started on the story. We were still hoping that we could find another artist for the story, but I knew that once we weren't doing the cover, I was like, once he wasn't able to do the cover, I was like, I actually was hoping that we were, because it's North America, there is a saying that North America is Turtle Island, and there is this legend of Star Woman who falls from the sky, lands on the back of a giant turtle, and the whole world is nothing but ocean and this turtle. And she sends a bunch of animals down under the water looking for land. And eventually, in the story that I know, it's Muskrat who goes down and dies diving so deeply beneath the waves, but then floats back up to the surface holding the smallest bit of dirt in his claws. And she takes that and spreads it over the turtle's back. And from that, the land is born, which is why on the cover, Turtle inside his shell has plants and trees to represent sort of what is to come. But I really quickly got the idea of like, well, that's the best way to represent all of North America. This is Turtle Island. This is the back of the turtle. So having that story on our cover would be amazing. And then each of the Cautionary Fables books has a different color scheme. Green, yellow, and red were taken. But blue hadn't been taken yet, and blue is my favorite color. This is all audio, so you can't see my like vibrantly blue hair. But I quite like that. So I was like, well, I'm calling blue. And it's the ocean, so that works great.
The press photos will be great because you can hold the book next to, obviously, your hair.
I will match.
You're going to match. I loved the stars that are in the clothing. I thought that that was really cool.
Are there? Did I put stars in the clothing? Yes, there are.
Mm-hmm. I forgot. It's really pretty. That's really pretty.
Yeah. It's kind of, I think actually I didn't notice it at first because there's a lot of things to focus on the cover. So I think I was looking through and just being kind of like, oh man, this is awesome for this reason and this reason. Obviously this turtle is amazing. And then I was like, oh, that's pretty.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I think I also put stars around her collar. They're the little diamond shapes are more stars because I was just like, let's double down on this theme. I want it to be real obvious who this is.
I'm interested to know about your time living in different countries and how that inspired you in your career to illustrating and web designing and publishing and just like loving all things nerdy. Like, what did you take in from like, I'm really curious. Were you able to just like mold into like other communities of nerds, like in different countries? Because I think I just want to have like an international like meetup of all nerds from all different backgrounds.
Oh man, that would be super cool. I didn't. The main big trip I did was, I mentioned that I went to animation school and then took a year off to travel. And I did that because I had applied for a internship program where they were sending Indigenous youth around the world to go and like experience other cultures. So I got paired up with another Indigenous woman who was a little bit older than me. I was the youngest one accepted into the program. I was like 17 at the time, and she was in her 20s. So we were both going to go, and she was kind of like, look after me. But we got sent to Fiji, and we lived in this like little rural community and then commuted into Suva every day to go work at an NGO doing like environmental work. So that was like already super mind-blowingly cool. But because I was so young and so nerdy, I was so shy, and I didn't really make a lot of friends out of the office, and I super regret not going out and finding, like, the cool Fijian nerds I know are out there. But yeah, so I didn't really meet any cool nerds while I was in Fiji. Shout out to all my Fiji friends. But while I was already halfway around the world, I'd saved up a little bit of money, and I was like, my grandma is currently teaching English in China. She had retired and she's a badass. So she was like, I have a bunch of money saved up and I don't want to be here anymore. So let's go somewhere else. So she went to China, decided to teach English. I was like, well, it's cheap to buy a flight from here to China. So let's go there and just hang out with her for a while. And I met some really cool nerdy friends there who were nerds in different ways. They were super, super, super into like video games. And I'd never really done the video game nerd thing. Like I played platforms and stuff, but these were like, we have like, this is like the early days of MMOs. And they were like, yeah, we got guilds and we got like rankings. We're like super into this. I was like, cool. I'm really bad at this game. If I play your character, it will die a lot. But that was still like a nice culture cross point.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah. And then after that, I came back to Canada and just hung out here for a bit, LARPing and drawing comics.
I was curious about if when you're in different places, do you write differently? Because I'll notice that about myself sometimes where whenever I'm, you know, if I'm sure we all travel at least a little bit. And whenever I'm in one place, I'll be like, you know, kind of retrospective, like kind of thinking back on my life or something. And then if I go somewhere else, I'm like, let's write something funny or, you know, something along those lines.
A little bit. Yeah. Actually, I don't know if it was the writing that changed, but definitely my reading habits changed. A couple years ago, we got to go on a trip with my partner. He is Canadian, but like of Norwegian descent. And his dad had done a bunch of research on where the family was from and found the farm that the family had lost in a like bad business venture that made them then move to Canada and try to start over. So my partner was like, I really want to go and like find my ancestors. And I'm like, that sounds rad. That must be weird being far away from them because like I'm Canadian Indigenous. So they're here. I talked to them. So we flew to Norway and being there was like the most alien thing to me. It was even stranger to me than being in Fiji or China, which kind of felt like more familiar, more Canada-like, even though Fiji is like as un-Canada as you can get. There was just something really wild about being so far up in the north. We went up all the way up to Tromsø, which is like north, north, north. And we managed to find like the old farm that his family had come from and like the church that was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old with all of the family members, all of his ancestors buried there. And that was just like a really powerful experience. And so I didn't write anything while I was there, but I suddenly started reading like all of these like Norse epics. And I wanted that like that kind of story when I was there.
Now I just want to travel there and read Heathen again.
Yeah.
Just be immersed in lesbian Norsedom. That's what I'm here for.
Awesome.
Well, hello there. I didn't see you come in. Welcome to the episode. This is S.E. Flenor, and I'd like to ask a favor of you today. Can you do me a favor? Are you open to a favor?
Does
it feel weird for me to ask you for a favor?
I have a curfew. I have to be back in by 7 p.m. But right now it's about a little bit after noon. So I think I've got some time.
Why do you have a curfew?
Good question. I guess I never really questioned it.
It's the cats. The cats gave you a curfew.
Yeah, like, pretty much.
Better have your bitch ass back here by 7 p.m. to feed me.
Also being a grandma, like I am 100% grandma sleeping schedule. So I'm like, 8 p.m., pretty late.
Seems like time for a nap / bedtime.
Anyway, the point is.
Okay, if you're going to do me the favor, whether or not you have a curfew, that favor is, can you go rate and review of the pod? Give us 5 stars. You could just say, oh man, bitches are cool. That's great. We love that. You could say, oh man, I've never loved Harley Quinn more. I'd be surprised, but I'd be okay with it. You could go in and say, wow, these interviews, they blow my mind. Or whatever you want to say. And now listen, hey, I know not every platform allows you to rate and review. For instance, I don't think Schmodishmai does, but you know what does? Schmapple. Schmodishmasher. So go over there. I'm not giving them free ads. Go over there, rate and review, and guess what? You don't even have to listen to us on those apps to rate and review us there. Don't tell anyone I told you, or tell everyone. Let's game the system, y'all. So rate and review us. 5 stars. I was going to say 5 stars for each bitch, but there's so many of us. That'd be like a billion stars. So give us a billion stars on your favorite podcast platform or Schmodishmasher or Schmapple.
Schmapple while you're drinking a Snapple.
We got to talk about Weregeeks because, as you started to say at the beginning of the episode, that was like 15 years of your life. I don't know if there are plans to continue it, so obviously that'll be part of the question. But I heard you say you started Weregeeks as almost like an accountability project to help you keep creating comics. Is that correct?
Yeah. Just to keep me drawing, even. And like, I didn't think about it at the time, but it was also teaching me how to write. So. For years, I was always like, oh, I'm an artist. I'm not really a writer. And then I'm like, wait, you've been writing a thing for like 8 years. You can start calling yourself a writer now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that's allowed. Yeah, so I really like it. It was totally different from Women in the Woods for many obvious reasons.
But I thought it was interesting. You also mentioned you didn't explore any of your indigeneity through it, but you did really dig in on your geekiness and geek culture and LARPing and video games. I read like every cast member's bio and I was like, yep, that's a very specific flavor of nerd. Mm-hmm. It was like, there's so much love for geeks here and for, again, D&D, LARPing, vampires, witches. There's just, it just oozes that love. And I want to know more about, why was that where you started? What was this love story for geeks? And then talk to me about the weregeek concept, because I am sold. I love it. And I just, you know, want to hear where that came from.
Okay, cool. So the whole concept behind weregeeks was, after I was done traveling around and I came back and I was like going, well, the whole animation thing didn't work out. What am I going to do with my life now? I ran into one of my friends from animation school and we started playing tabletop games again together. And, I got her involved in LARPing because I'd sort of fallen into LARPing at that point too. And I was like, you got to come try this out. It's amazing. I know that you're kind of gothy and like there's this thing where once a month we can go and actually pretend to be vampires. It's great. And she's like, sold. Love it. Let's do this. So I brought her into the game that I was playing, but, we were sort of like, we'd see each other during the day in like a sort of more professional corporate outfits. And then at night we would show up like dressed like vampires or do our tabletop games dressed like nerds. And we joked that we were weregeeks because we were like only nerds by night. So that was the whole idea that like sat in the back of my brain. I was like, I really need to do something about this. It's such a great concept. I want to play around with that. So that was the whole idea behind my comic. Which originally wasn't going to go for 15 years. I was like, I will do this for like a few years. And like, yeah, right. I was like, I'll just dive down into this idea. I'll tell a couple funny stories about these people who are like nerds by night. Although in my book, they actually like turn into big like shadow creatures, when they are geeking out. And that's a whole storyline. But yeah, that I did it like in my spare time to start out with while I was still working corporate jobs as a graphic designer for like big firms. And then I was working on a magazine at one point and we all got laid off because magazines are going under left, right, and center. And that, I think at that point I'd been doing it for about 8 years and I'd started going to comic conventions and trying to sell, my print collections and some of the shirts I'd made. And I was getting to the point where I was like, I can do this full time, I think, if I really push. So that's where I made the transition to go in full time on weregeek. And at that point I was committed and I really fallen in love with the characters that I was writing about who were very, 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 very loosely based on some of the people that I met, but more sort of based on the archetypes of nerds that I'd met through nerddom, through like LARPing and conventions and all of that great stuff. So I was just like, well, I got more stories to tell with these characters. Let's keep going and just see where this ends up. And 15 years later, I'm finally to a point where I have an ending in sight, want to end it, but COVID happened and that was a whole year. So I lost my momentum on that at the same point as I also lost my income stream of conventions. So I've had to set that ending aside. The final chapter is like partially written, but I've had no time to work on it because I am expanding all the freelancing stuff. Hence the multiple anthologies that I've got going on right now.
Yeah. Do you think you'll be going to any conventions this year?
I'm going to one this weekend.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So getting back in it.
Yeah, we got Vancouver Comics Arts Festival on this very weekend in Vancouver. It's gonna be fun.
Amazing. What are you most looking forward to with getting back to conventions?
Oh God, just seeing everybody again. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how Cal and I met. That's how Spike and I met. We were just all doing the same sort of thing. We all would get put into the like webcomics area of the cons that we exhibited at. And then afterwards we do this thing where you like stumble out in a haze and you're like, oh, I'm hungry and I've talked to people all day, we need to eat, where are we going? And then one of us would like be like, hey, there's a place nearby, let's go and eat there.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah,
that's beautiful. Well, I, you know, weregeeks is so fun. I mean, I honestly, I love that you were like, you know, there's probably a couple years of stories here, and then you turn around one day and it's been 15 years. Like, that's, you're a whole new person since you started weregeeks. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like twice over, your cells have like reset themselves.
Totally.
Like, what do you think is the big thing you've learned through weregeeks?
Oh God, everything. Like literally everything.
highly relatable. It's been 15 years. It would be hard to choose one thing.
I learned I was a writer. I learned how to do backgrounds and layouts, which is something that I was really sucked at back when I was at animation school. I learned how to manage a business and order merch, and I learned how to ship stuff on pallets across the country. I can do logistics now, which is weird. I learned how to do my own taxes, which sucks because I have to do it in two different countries. So I learned it real good because I have to do it twice. But yeah, like literally I learned everything. And part of that I learned by like going to these conventions and chatting with people who are doing the same things and being like, so how do you do your taxes, or who do you ship through, or where do you get your merch from?
Aw, really, really was about the comics community. I love that.
Yeah, totally.
That's so inspiring that you learned all of those like skills, and it's very like DIY oriented, which I think is really awesome. And I'm really interested to know, like, as far as like community goes, have you always felt that by creating like within your community that you also present an opportunity for more diverse narratives to come out of it? And especially if it's like a more welcoming community of everyone?
Yeah, totally. I know that like last VanCaf that happened before the whole COVID thing and we were shut down for several years, I was on a really cool panel run by Cool Pauls and Saragones Esquivel. I'm probably butchering his last name. But there was this like panel at VanCaf that was talking about Indigenous representation in comics. And it was four of us Indigenous creators all together, which I'd never been in a room with that many Indigenous creators before who were all in comics. I was just like, this is rad. I love this. But we all had really similar stories of like growing up, the only places we saw Indigenous representation on TV or in media was really weird. It was like the weird space natives in Star Trek who showed up and like kidnapped Wesley Crusher, and then they would like wander out into the universe in a weird mystical way. Or like some of the really, really bad representation in comics, like Black Hawk, and oh, my mind has gone completely blank of all of the Indigenous cape characters, but some of them were not great. Most of them were not great. And we all were like, yeah, yeah. But like, even if they weren't great, it was literally the only thing that we saw ourselves in the pages. So we were still like, yeah, this is cheesy and real, not how we are, but like, we're still like big fans. And how we were like, so the thing we need that we owe to the next generations is that they get to see themselves in comics, that they can pick up a book and be like, yeah, actually that is how Cree people are. And I feel like really represented here and really loved. And that attitude is really spreading across the whole nerd world. I don't know if you're aware of a really cool tabletop role-playing system called Coyote and Crow, but it is this amazing, amazing book that is just like a world like no other, that is all Indigenous people being rad in a really cool fantasy high-tech setting. And I actually bought a couple extra copies that I'm going to take to my reserve and leave there in the library. So hopefully the kids on my reserve can like see themselves and role play in a system that really supports them.
That sounds so awesome. It happens for all like marginalized folks, like within comics, like how these like stereotypes just seem to follow us. And also there's just like this like hesitancy to actually employ writers who are actually well-versed in their own culture and everything else that could provide some like measure of authenticity to whatever publication they actually pull out. And I feel like the work still hasn't been done, even though there have been like some like quote-unquote attempts at diversity. But like there are still so many creators that are being overlooked, and a lot of their stories are not given like the love that they deserve. So kudos to you for holding the torch, you know?
Yeah, thank you. I feel really honored to sort of be able to have the contacts from doing cons over the years to now be able to turn around and go like, cool, I got my start doing anthologies. I now want every other Indigenous person who wants to do comics to have the same opportunity. So how can I make that happen? And feel super honored to know Spike and be like, hey, here's a thing that I would like to do. Would you be cool with that? And she's like, yeah, I'm on board. That sounds great. Because she gets that. She gets how important it is to see yourself represented like that. So we're actually working on another project coming up 2024 called Indigenerds, which I will be the editor on, sole editor on this one. And it is going to be like stories of modern Indigenous life. So Indigenous people interacting with the modern world, but especially with technology and pop culture. So this is going to be like, do you and your family cosplay? Tell us that story. Or tell us a story about using apps to like coordinate rides on the Powwow Trail.
That is so rad. I'm like sold by the title alone. That is such a great title.
Thank you.
Yes. And I hope that when you launch the book, like, just please, like, make merch, because I'm pretty sure a lot of kids will be, like, really into that. So that's awesome. Yeah.
And you'll have to come back to the podcast, obviously.
I guess.
You're in now. Obviously. You're in the group. We're never going to let you go. You're our friend now.
I'm going to tell you now, you messed up by coming on this podcast, because once you do, you're in. And I am living testament to that.
Monica used to be a guest, and then she was a very frequent guest. And then we were like, hey, host this.
And then 15 years later.
Yeah. It was like, oh, do you want to do like a Patreon special with us? And then it was, oh, would you like to do two or three more of those and also do a regular episode? And then eventually I'm living upstairs.
I've been kidnapped. I hold it true.
Oh, my. Dear listeners, Monica has not actually been kidnapped. I just want to be very clear about that. The optics on that would be real bad. Like, that is not good stuff. Yes, Monica is here of her own free
will. Of my own volition, yes, yes. Help
me. It doesn't
me.
Help that I'm saying it.
Help. That makes it sound more.
Sorry, oh, Kate, dear. You can cut out the my pleas for help. I'm just kidding.
This is my life now. Oh.
Okay, I would love to hear a little bit about Life Finds a Way, which, A, when at the beginning you were like, I like dinosaurs, and I was like, I think you might.
Yeah, maybe.
That title is like, yeah, straight out of Jurassic Park. Maybe also other places. So tell me a little bit about what that process was like and, yeah, anything you learned or any big takeaways or also, I don't know, where people can find it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll start with that one. People can find it at cloudscapecomics.com. Like I said, that's the local comics collective that are set up here in Vancouver. So it's a bunch of indie creators all over the greater Vancouver area all getting together to support each other and make rad books together. Big shout out to them. They're awesome. But Life Finds a Way happened when my friend Dan Engtel, who's my co-editor on that one, came to me and was like, I am a writer. I do not do comics, but I would like to make a comics anthology and don't know how to make that happen. Here's the pitch. Hopeful post-apocalypse. Because we've been having a bunch of conversations about how this is back when like zombie everything was super popular. Like Walking Dead was like at its height. And all of the post-apocalypses were this like real hyper masculine survival oriented every man for himself kind of thing. And we're like, that's not how humans are. We make communities and friends and we like to be kind to each other. And I think that the more pressure that is put on us from the outside, the more we'll actually come together. And I think that we could really use some of that hope right now. Pre 2020 Alina didn't know what they were going to face. But yeah, so it like became weirdly prescient because the book actually launched just as COVID was ramping up to the point at which Dan and I were sitting down and being like, I don't think we should have a launch party for this because I think we aren't going to be able to do gatherings soon. Maybe let's hold off. So that book has never had a launch and it's been out for 2 years because we just can't be in public anymore right now. But also became this weirdly like, hey, so we have this book about like hopeful stories in a post-apocalyptic setting that seems real topical right now. And it's all stories of like survival and coming together and building communities. And we didn't want stories about like the apocalypse happening. We wanted the apocalypse has happened. People are still around. We're picking up the pieces and rebuilding. What does that look like?
I love that. One of my favorite stories we ever published with
Decoded was about a very hopeful post-apocalyptic story. And to me, I'm like, those are so unique to pair, like, the true resilience of humanity, the true, and, you know, I say one, but there's actually been a handful that we've published with Decoded, and love them all. There's just something really special about taking something so terrible and saying, like, no, we're still here. Because I don't remember who said this, but, like, the world is ending all the time, right? Like, we're living through these apocalypses, I guess maybe is the plural, all the time, right? Like, terrible things are happening, and yet we are able to build communities of care. We're able to love each other. We're able to build alternative economies. Like, wow, humans are amazing. So I was really excited to learn about Life Finds a Way. And I think I saw it was like 20 stories. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to eat that up. I'm going to go buy it right now.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, here's kind of a cheat is Indigenous people are super into post-apocalypse stories because we've lived through several apocalypses. There was a literal genocide on this continent. That we've survived and carried on and kept our culture strong and resilient. So, like, that really resonates for Indigenous folks. And that was part of the reason why when Dan pitched it to me, I was like, I am in. I love dystopias, but I also love thinking about how to fix dystopias and how to carry on in, like, a really strong way.
Very different experience, but whenever I watched The Walking Dead, I also was incredibly infuriated the whole time and just being like, why do they always, it's always just cop stuff. It's always just the cop in charge. And it just bummed me out so much.
It's because they're all being written by white guys.
It's written by cops.
Yep, it's a problem.
Yeah, it was a problem. It was a recurring problem during my Walking Dead watch, for sure. Where I was just like, this system doesn't work. No wonder you were focusing on people and they're just like, oh no, we've been attacked again and now half of us are dead. And you're just like, yeah, because you fight with everybody who you come across.
Mm-hmm. And the solution is always violence. And you're like,
they're
no.
Like, you know what? I think it's just going to be me and this guy. We're going to fight it out. Just like, all right. I thought about that too, because I was always like, I wonder what zombies would be happy doing other than eating people. Like, I think about that, like, where I'm just like, is there a way? Has anybody tried to mediate with the zombie?
Right. They're not very smart. You can outthink them.
That's why I love the wild so much. I feel like Vita and Emily, I believe, were playing with that. And it was like, ah, oh, they're such beautiful zombies too. Yeah, there's a lot of fertile ground there for people to still kick around in. I think the best of zombies is yet to come. That's what I'll say.
I agree.
I'm not sure why I needed to say that, but...
No, I mean, it's real though, because I think a lot of people are like, zombies are over. And I'm like, we haven't even told anything good yet. Like, or I mean, there is some good stuff.
You know, that reminds me, Stephanie Williams always talks about this when she's on the pod. People will be like, superheroes are over. It's been done. And she's like, why do you all always do this right when Black people, women, Indigenous people, and queers mm-hmm. get to write
but
them?
That's what they what mean. That? That's mm-hmm. what they mean. It's over for them, apparently, even though we already know that that's not the case. They're just being little bitches about it.
Not the good kind of bitches.
Not the good kind of bitches. Just like, just petulant toddlers. And it's so annoying. It's so annoying. I just, yeah.
Yeah, agree.
Yeah.
I was wondering, you have a bunch of, yeah, as we were saying, you have so many projects that are in the works. Do you have something in mind that you haven't gotten to try? Because it seems like you've really been... You've done a lot of different creative things, right? Mm. So is there something that's just been kind of at the back of your mind, kind of just compelling you and being like, oh, I can't wait until I have time to work on that without giving anything away? I don't want to ask you to like give away anything.
Oh, that's fine.
But is there something that is soon to come?
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I want to try my hand at that I haven't done yet is writing a novel, and I am 20,000 words into one. It's going to be a YA cyberpunk novel. So I was like, hey, I could write. I guess I'm a writer. Let's try this out. We'll see if I can finish that off and then find somebody to pick it up.
If they don't, I will fight them in these streets. All of them. You give me the list of people who reject your book. And you're like, violence doesn't solve anything. I'm like, but it will in this case.
Excellent. This is actually one of the rules in my cyberpunk novel is like so many cyberpunk novels have the same problem that so many of the zombie stories do, that like the only solution is violence. And it's usually like one lone protagonist against the world. And I'm like, that's not how any of this works. It's all collective action. And you gotta be on your own. So the protagonist in this story actually has a set of rules. And one of the rules is you cannot do violence by your own hand. So I think that puts a very different spin on the cyberpunk genre.
Yeah. Well, I'm ready to read it right now.
Awesome.
Just send it over when you finish it.
Send it over.
I was thinking about that too, because that really is kind of how it goes with writing books. I can't speak for everybody in the room right now, but I will say that whenever it was like, oh, maybe you should write a book. And I was like, oh, like maybe I should.
It was the very first time
it came to me. And then you're just like, yeah, I wrote like a bunch of words for this. For me, I made it to a place where I was like, oh, none of this works. I'm just going to have to rewrite the whole thing. So, I didn't have a lot of intentionality behind it. So people are just like, oh, you should plan out your book. Hey, it turns out that is actually really good information. just have an idea of where you're going. I was just like, I want this to happen, and this to happen.
Right.
And then it was like, oh, they have to be connected. Those events have to be connected.
I think I did it backwards because I'm so used to planning meticulously for comics because it's like such a time-consuming project that like I was like, I want to write a novel. Here is the entire outline in like sub-point forms, and that's my writing. And then I sat there and I was like, oh, I actually have to put words into this. I should prose this now. It's not like doing comic scripts where I would then take the point form and just put dialogue on it. I need to like describe things.
Oh, writing, it's hard.
It makes me cry.
Yeah. I feel like everybody in this room is working on a book. So I think this is particularly poignant.
As we all stare off into the middle distance.
Oh, yeah.
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 I was legitimately looking at a jay bird outside of my window going, you know what? What even is a book? What does it mean to book? So yes, I identify very much with what everyone just said.
What does it mean to book? So my God.
So now we call it a book just because it has two covers and a bunch of pages in between.
Oh my gosh. I'll be talking to my therapist about this later next week.
Too much.
Well, I did have one question, but I think it's totally off like grid, but like I stumbled in when you and Sarah were talking and y'all were talking about anime, and I'm a former weeb, you know, like when I was a teenager, I was like very much like wow, just out there and like thinking about like Duo and Death Scythe Hell Custom, and I used to do builds like that and stuff, like, but I don't have the time to do that anymore. But nice. I used to watch like Tenchi Muyo, and I was really into like Magical Girl series and reading manga. And I think that horror manga is like some of the best like comics that are out there. So I just want to know like
second.
What kind of recs you got? Did you say second?
Yeah, I really like horror manga. Sarah turned me on to it. And I'm
It's so scary.
And then sometimes just so weirdly like funny, disgusting. And that's like a feeling I enjoy very much.
I just finished Romina, which was a gift. And
from who?
From my favorite Aries, Sarah Century. And it is like,
I hear she's got good taste. No.
And it's probably one of my favorite mangas that I've read this year. So I just want to know if you want to drop some recs on us, you know, drop some knowledge, you know, about what anime, what manga we should be reading, what inspires you. I know this is a very big, big question.
That's a big question. I mean, I'm old school. So like, I really got into manga, like I said, because it was like an alternative to the Kate books. There was a little bookseller down the street from my house that I could go to. And they had a tiny manga shelf, and I wandered across, ran my half, and like got super, super into it. And there's like a million of them. And then I started reading some of Rumiko Takahashi's other stuff. So I got like really into Inuyasha, created like an Inuyasha OC that I role played on a forum, did lots of fan art. I also into Sailor Moon back in the day. It was like my first experience with anime at all was me and my teen friends watching it on like VHS dubs that we got in the mail, which tells you how old I am. Yeah. I could actually draw fan art of Sailor Moon and trade it with some of my classmates for snacks.
Yo, so that was like, that's such a racket. Awesome. Congrats.
So good. They're like, you can draw? Can you draw me Sailor Jupiter? And I'm like, yeah.
Amazing. Awesome.
I do that for free.
I also love Sailor Moon so
much. Oh, yeah. Yes. I used to get up at like 5:30 in the morning just to catch Sailor Moon on, I think it was on a television station called UPN. When I was growing up, I don't think UPN exists anymore. But yeah, I would get up early in the morning just to watch Sailor Moon. Nice. Because it was such an important part of my childhood. And it actually like opened the gates for me to become like a really big anime fan.
For so many people, I think, right? There was a time when they were showing it on Cartoon Network. And that was whenever I was watching it. Was that before this? I'm guessing, because I feel like I must have been, I don't know, like 10 or 12 or something whenever that was happening.
I think they were, because I mean, there was Toonami, which was like the platform where they showed like a lot of anime. And that's how I got into Dragon Ball Z and Gundam Wing and like Tenchi Muyo and like all that stuff. So it was the gateway drug for sure. I also realized I was very gay with Sailor Moon.
I was just saying, Sailor Moon might be like the earliest thing I can remember that was actually like, is this queer? Question marks.
Oh,
they tried super hard to straight wash that shit. It was so funny.
It's so funny to watch it though, because she's all like gazing dreamily into Uranus's eyes, and then it's just like, yeah, my cousin. And everybody's like, what? Oh, yeah, totally. And you're watching it, like, that's more weird. What are you doing?
Like, super weird. Like, this is.
Now, they still look like they're having sex. Like, they still look like these two are super into each other. You didn't make it not look like that. You just made it weirder because now they're cousins. And I'm just like, I don't think it's chill to be like that with your cousin.
That was the wrong message to send to children. I'm sorry.
Like, yeah. Which character? Because I loved Sailor Neptune because she's so sad girl with a violin and is all just like across the room, like looking at her crush being like, you. And then just like walking away. And I'm just like, that's me. Whenever I was like 12, I was just like, that's my favorite character.
Yes.
In the world.
I was really into Sailor Jupiter. Yeah. I was really into Sailor Jupiter.
I identified with Sailor Mercury, but like had a crush on Sailor Jupiter.
Okay. Yeah. Sailor Mercury. Yeah. She was definitely the Gemini of the group, but like not like. I feel like she was like a mixture. Am I really doing the astrology signs of Sailor Moon characters right now? Yeah, Sailor Mercury, like she always had like her wit and like, you know, whatever. But I also really like Chibi Moon. She was my favorite too. But also Luna and Artemis, like, yeah, good times, good times.
I was hoping somebody would say that they were the Tuxedo Mask.
Oh, God, yes.
I wish I could be Tuxedo Mask. I'm such a Neptune, and then I'm just like, Tuxedo Mask, he just gets to show up and leave.
I know, right? And like the coolest way to like, all right, no explanation, I'm just going to throw a rose and disappear.
I'm going to claim that for myself now. Be like indigenous auntie and be like, show up, be like, sort out your shit, and then just leave.
The dream, pop off, that disappear.
Well, I loved this, but was there any other recommendations that you had off of the top of your head?
I can't think of anything but Sailor Moon now.
I know. That's what we're going to, this is the podcast now.
The Sailor Moon Power
Hour. Sailor Moon podcast now. And join us next week when our same guests will be exactly what they are this week. Oh my God. You have mentioned a couple of the projects that you have coming up, but I would love for you to plug absolutely anything else that you can plug here at the top of the hour.
I have plugged Coyote and Crow already. Check them out. They're amazing. Check out Red Planet Comics, all the best indigenous comics. They are rad. A Howl is coming out soon, and I think I mentioned that briefly. I'm in it, but also it is like the biggest collection of Indigenous artists and writers that I've ever seen. There's like 50 of us. It's going to be a tome. I've seen the PDF copy, and it's all amazing. All of the stories are all about werewolves. I'm also a big werewolf nerd. So like having like 50 stories about werewolves and all Indigenous, I love it. It's candy to me. Check that out. Like, those are my shout outs.
Red Planet Comics in Albuquerque, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
They host the Indigenous Comic Con, which I want to go to one of these years.
It's so cool. Yeah, I think that's such a cool idea. I missed it, and I don't remember what the deal was. It was basically, I was going to go with one of my friends, and then just things fell through or something. Mm-hmm. So I also would love to at least just go and be able to support, because there's always, I saw that lineup, you know, just like, I want to go drop like $200. Yeah, for sure. People should definitely check out all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So listeners, if there's any part where you missed out, you didn't hear what was said, you know, like you got up, you went to get a snack, you came back and you were like, oh, didn't they just say something? I was supposed to, oh man, I didn't write that down. I didn't have a pen on me. This happens to me all of the time. And guess what? Nothing. I forget about it immediately. You don't have to forget about it. We have show notes. I encourage you to check out the show notes, because we're going to have all kinds of information, links, you can click on everything.
You can check those out by hitting the three dots somewhere around the title of the show, or a picture of someone's face. Just hit a bunch of three dots and then see what happens. Alina, you have been delightful. You have made us laugh. This beautiful anthology brought me to tears several times. I was texting Sarah this morning like, I'm just crying a lot, because it's so beautiful. And we are just so excited to have you here to talk about Women in the Woods and all of your other great work. I'm going to go read all of Weregeeks. I haven't quite made it through. I think I'm only through like half of chapter one. So I'm looking forward to learning more about those nerds and what, I'm sorry, those geeks and what they're up to. Because they're delightful.
I was going to say, a full archive dive is an undertaking. I'm sorry. It's going to take a while.
You know, I have a deep passion for doing one thing for a very long time. So.
There's 15 years of 3 days a week. That's thousands and thousands of comics.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see how far I get. Thank you so much for being here, Alina. You are the coolest. We really appreciate
you
your time.
Much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks so much for having me. This has been an amazing conversation. I feel like we could talk for like another hour.
I know. Well, you have to come back. And like Monica said, whoopsie doodle, now you are part of
it. I live here.
Yep.
Hi. Help yourself to the couch. I'm adopted. I'm part of the family.
Yeah, you just go ahead and open the fridge, get whatever you need. You know, that's what we're here for.
Here's our needlessly complicated remote control for the television.
There's actually four of them. I'm really sorry.
My God.
I haven't figured out how to get them to
work. That's actually my real life.
Awful. Awful.
Monica's like, get out of here, leave.
I'm so over it.
Monica, run for your life. Monica and Sarah, as always, you are just perfect. I would change nothing about you. Thank you for making me laugh, for making me think hard on every episode of the podcast. You are gifts to my life. Kate, thank you so much for making us so smart. You're going to cut so many things that I said weird. Like I almost said the C word there instead of cut. You know, we appreciate that. Thank you for making us sound great and coherent. It is very helpful. Listeners, we couldn't be here without you. You know the joke, we could, but it would be strange. And we really appreciate you being here, listening, liking, rating, reviewing, supporting us on Patreon. Patrons, what is there to say except I love you with my whole heart and then some. All right, everybody, thank you for a great day. Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @BitchesOnComics and on Instagram at @BitchesOnComics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.